Our first speaker today is, let me just, by way of context, note that we are in the middle, of course, of the beginning of implementation of healthcare reforms passed a year and a half ago. And the process is moving unevenly, shall we say, throughout the country. Some states like mine, California, are very aggressively moving to implement healthcare reform. Others are lagging and dragging their heels, some literally, and others more politically, just posturing, and actually at the same time taking federal grants and beginning to move through a process of creating health exchanges, as one example. So it's very helpful to reflect on some of the issues surrounding the implementation of healthcare reform, and including how it comes about and how it gets implemented. Our first speaker is Dr. Harry Perlstadt, who is professor of sociology at Michigan State University. He received his PhD from the University of Oregon and, Chicago. I misread it. My apologies. And his MPH from the University of Michigan. He has done extensive evaluations of many programs, both internationally and nationally and domestically. And in 2010, he was a Fulbright lecturer on U.S. healthcare policy and politics at Semmelweis University in Budapest. He's going to be speaking about the role of ideology, opportunism, and pragmatism in healthcare reform. Harry?
Thank you. I have no personal financial relationships with regard to this presentation, and I'll skip a couple of slides so that we can have a little bit more time for discussion. You can, they're up on the website, and you can email me or download it. Okay, so the overview of the talk is that political ideology and party affiliation influence our perceptions of healthcare reform. Avidus Danabedian proposed in the 1970s a topology of liberal, libertarian, and egalitarian values relevant to healthcare policy and reform, which I'll present to you very briefly. There's some public opinion surveys showing these differences for the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. Very briefly, I'll talk about Max Weber's views on rational action and ideology and politics. And then the main part will be, are we going to go down the same road that Australia went down when they passed their healthcare reform in 1975? And then very briefly, my sort of foggy crystal ball on what I think might be happening in the near future. Okay, so Avidus Danabedian had social values, personal responsibility, social concern, freedom, and equality. And this chart basically shows the two sides, libertarian and egalitarian. So in terms of medical care, libertarians believe that it's part of the reward system. Egalitarians think that medical care should not be part of the reward system. In terms of charity, libertarians believe that they should not fully meet needs, that people should not get a total free ride, whereas egalitarians basically look at it in terms of charity to prevent poverty and illness. So these aren't quite on the same track there. The role of the government, of course, libertarians view collective action as paternalism. Egalitarians view health services as public goods. And access for libertarians should be limited. There's a limited list of rights listed in the U.S. Constitution, for example, and medical care is not one of them. And egalitarians believe that there should be a right to medical care. Very briefly, in 2007, there was a survey found that Democrats and those not believing in limited government believed that there should be government intervention to reduce health disparities. And a 2009 poll found liberals and Democrats in Massachusetts claimed the state's health reform was a success, while conservatives and Republicans considered it a failure. I got this data, this next chart off the Kaiser Foundation, Family Foundation Health Tracking Poll for September, and I'm highlighting just a few of them. As you can see, 65% of the Democrats were favorable to the health reform law compared to 14% of Republicans. Interestingly enough, not even a majority of the Democrats are in favor of keeping the individual mandate, only 44%, and of course only 12% of the Republicans believe that. In terms of expanding the law, sort of interesting, almost half the Democrats, 48%, believe it could be expanded, and obviously the Republicans are not interested in that. Keep the law as is, the highest one is 26% for Democrats. So it's clear that people are not exactly satisfied with the Affordable Care Act in a variety of ways. 43% of Republicans want to repeal and replace it with a Republican alternative. Only 5% of Democrats agree. And repeal and not replace, 32% of Republicans and only 11% of Democrats. So there's not a whole lot of consensus in this. Max Weber talks about two kinds of rationality, what he calls vert rationale, value-oriented action that's expressive. And I see this as being, and he saw it as being, symbolic politics. No compromise or cost accounting, no rational weighing of one end against the other. And these are the either-or issues. Abortion, yes or no. Gun control, yes or no. School prayer, yes or no. On the other hand, there's VEC rationale, which is goal instrumental, where you weigh considerations of whether there's undesirable consequences should outweigh the benefits. We've seen this in the debates over whether to draw down the troops and how quickly and what to leave behind. Immigration also, although some people want to make it an either-or thing, it's quite clear that it's a much more complicated issue, and so I think immigration law fits this example as well. And basically, most political parties are vert rationale. They're ideologically oriented and motivated. And so the liberals are gender and racial equality, environmental protection, and the conservatives, lower taxes, smaller government, and free market. Okay. The question is Australia the future of youth healthcare politics over the next 25 years or 15 years? Australia has a federal system. There are six states, two major territories. They have a population of 22.7 million, which is a little bit smaller than Texas. The parliament is divided between a Labor Party on the left and a coalition on the right of Liberal and a National Party. In 1975, the Labor Party established a national universal health insurance. But the, as you'll see in a minute, the coalition dismantled it in 76 to 81, then Labor got back and tried to reinstate it and so on. I'll give you more of the details here. So this is the overall. In 75, Labor passed what was called Medibank, the insurance plan. From 76 to 83, the Conservative coalition made Medibank 2, Mark 2 through 4. Then Labor got back 84 to 88 and 88 to 96, about 12 years, and they redid Medicare funding. Then in 96 through 2007, for 11 years, the Conservative coalition got in there and changed the rules. And then since 2007, Labor has been the majority in the government, and they have yet another funding agreement. So in 1975, Medibank was passed by Labor to provide the most equitable and efficient means of providing health insurance for all Australians. It was going to be universal in coverage, equitable in distribution of costs, and administratively simple to manage. It would set up an independent statutory authority. It would be funded entirely from general revenue. There was supposed to be a tax levy, but the Conservatives in the Senate in Australia voted against it. There'd be free treatment for public patients at public state-owned hospitals, a 50% federal payback to operating costs, and subsidizing private insurance. It was implemented state by state starting July through October 1975. In November, the Labor Party lost a vote of confidence, and they were dismissed, and it lost the 1975 election, and the Conservatives got in power. So in between 76 and 1981, the Conservative coalition put in a 2.5% levy on income, which they had opposed a year earlier. They had an opt-out, so if you have health insurance, you don't have to pay private health insurance, you don't have to pay the levy. They changed it so the federal government pays 50% of all approved net operating hospital costs, not all hospital costs. And then they set up a health insurance commission to offer private health insurance, public Medibank public. So it was in a government-owned private insurance, started successfully, and it's still going on. It competes with other private funds, and it's the second largest in Australia. They abolished the health, and then between 70 and 81, they abolished the health insurance levy. People didn't like paying that, and the compulsion to insure, the mandate, if you will. They had a large tax rebate before if people had private insurance. They did have to give free care to pensioners and other meeting more stringent means tests. And Medibank Public ended, so they ended the public aspect of it. Then labor got back in from 84 to 96, and they got this in because they also made it part of a larger economic reforms. Free hospital service was included. They reinstated a Medicare levy, which crept up from 1 to 1.25% of taxable income. In hospitals, there was a rebate of 75%, meaning that people had to pay 25% of their insurance. During this time, the private health insurance fund membership fell from in 1983 to 1996 as Labor Progressive abolished the subsidies for private health insurance. So there was a disincentive to buy it in Australia, and public and private insurance fell. And then they introduced a series of contracts between the health insurance funds and the hospitals and the funds and the doctors in order to reduce out-of-payment pockets. Then the coalition gets back in, and they reimpose the Medicaid levy surcharge as a financial penalty on individuals earning above a certain threshold amount if they were not to purchase health insurance. So there was this game about who's paying and who's not. There was a lifetime health cover, which means that if you didn't buy health insurance by the time you were 30, when you joined, you had to pay more, which is the same thing if you don't do your Medicare Part A and B when you're 65, you pay penalties. And these policies boosted up private health insurance membership up to 45%. So the conservatives pushed up private health insurance. Then in 2007, labor got back in. Rudd, who was the prime minister, reached a deal where the federal government would take responsibility for 60% of the funding for the hospital system, but he wanted what they call a clawback, a take back from the states in terms of what their taxes were. And basically a woman named Gillard challenged him, the first woman prime minister of Australia, and she agreed to a 50-50 cost sharing. She established a single national health funding pool for all the insurances, shared federal and state activity based on funding arrangements for public state hospitals. The more procedures a hospital does, the more funding it will get. A new independent hospital pricing authority will set national prices across the country in Australia, and Medicare locals to provide access to services and integrate care between primary, hospital, and age. And the aged care sectors, this is very similar to what we think HMO should be doing and what's going on in England with locals and the well. So the politics behind this is that they had four major systems but in the 1970s alone. It's by 79, the confusion was so great that a conservative editor wrote, it's a total unmitigated disaster, a nightmare for the general public. Consensus did not develop, and strong opposition from private sector interests resurfaced in the early 1990s, and this was fueled by a recession as private insurance decreased to 36%. In the 1990s, labor faced enormous pressures to privatize the financing system, and in March 93, there was a major election, and labor won the election, and so that sort of settled it. And the rest of the time they've spent trying to how they're going to finance it the rest of the way. And so my co-author contact in Australia says the reform failed because the reforms favored either public or private insurance, not to make them competitors, and there was no agreement on how to harmonize public and private insurance. And so finally, as you know, 15 state legislatures have passed laws, and voters in two states approved constitutional amendments here in the U.S. opposing the Affordable Care Act, the state of Florida decision. The district judge held that the whole thing was unconstitutional, but on appeal a couple of months ago, the 11th Circuit in Atlanta held that the part of the law requiring the purchase of insurance, the individual mandates, is unconstitutional, but did not require wholesale invalidation of the law, and it have held the law's expansion of the Medicaid program, which is why I think the Obama administration is going to have the Supreme Court focus just on the mandate, and it looks like the rest of the law will not be reviewed. So the decision could be announced as in late June 2012 at the beginning of the presidential and congressional campaign seasons. This is a case where the Supreme Court would proceed, not follow the election returns, as Mr. Dooley said 100 years ago. And my crystal ball basically says, regardless of who wins the 2012 election, neither party is likely to command the 60-vote majority in the U.S. Senate to pass any substantive changes. So whatever the Supreme Court basically decides, I guess, is what they'll argue about in the fall and go on with that. Okay, now I have a list of references and questions and comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Harry. We have plenty of time for some questions from the audience, if there are any. Yes. Would you introduce yourself, please?
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm Brenda Stevenson Marshall, Dean of Health Sciences at Boston College in Missouri.
Okay.
And I'd like to thank you for using Down to Medieval Chart. Those of us who have memorized that and all 800 pages of this book are deeply appreciative. And, you know, just in terms of healthcare reform, do you think we'll ever move to the point where we see this as an entitlement, or do you think we're always going to have this tug of war between this being a meritocracy and entitlement?
I'm just going to repeat the gist of the questions for the recording of this session. The questioner thanked Harry for speaking about Don Abedian and using his model of egalitarianism and libertarianism, and asked whether we would ever get to a point where healthcare reform and the structures and policies put in place by it might be seen as an entitlement rather than something that was more of, basically the egalitarian perspective as opposed to the libertarian perspective.
As I suggested, I think it might take at least 12 to 16 years in the United States to even start coming close to that. And as you can see in Australia, even though both sides by 1993-94 agreed that there should be a national health insurance plan, they were still debating how much should be paid, how much the taxes should be, how much the federal government should be involved in the hospital services, and now the Labor Party is going into HMOs or the equivalent in Australia. It just seems to be never ending, and so I don't think any time before 2028 will this at least be in some way settled.
Okay, we can take one more question. Yes, sir.
Tom Prendergast, I'm retired from Southern California. Do you think there's any traction for a health care plan as opposed to a health insurance plan at the national level?
The question was, is there any traction for a health care plan rather than a health insurance plan? And I'll let you interpret that, Harry, and then answer it.
Okay. In terms of setting up the equivalent of a national health service like they have in England or one that's fairly close like in Italy or Sweden, I don't think there's much of a chance in the United States at all during my lifetime. And I don't have a whole long, I'm in my late 60s, so I don't expect to see it. Okay, you can, when you see me later, you can tell me.
Ben.
Is there any possibility that the Congress in this country will set up a yardstick program by which to measure the effectiveness of the private insurance industry?
In other words,
something like the public option that was discarded in.
Is there a possibility in this country of setting up something like a benchmark plan, like the public option was to be, that didn't get into the final bill of health care reform, that would be used by people to judge the performance of private health insurance plans?
Well, one could hope that the health quality assurance part of HHS could fund these kinds of things. I think the data is out there to be able to compare some of this stuff, if we could get at it and make it a large research project and compare it. I don't know whether that Congress really doesn't do that. I think that's more of an administrative decision in AHRQ and the insurance industry. But I think the data's out there, and I think we could evaluate that sort of stuff.
Thank you, Harry. And if I may just add to your response, I think that Ben's question really was about having a plan that people could look at concretely as an exemplary plan. And I think Harry's point is that he doesn't see that happening perhaps right now, but that there are also provisions in the Affordable Care Act for evaluating the health insurance plans and certain rules they must abide by and ways to measure whether they are performing according to those rules or not. And so that would become the yardstick, although not in a comparison to another plan.